Now, who doesn't have a memory at the NBC, the Neil Blaisdell Center, the arena, the concert hall, and the exhibition hall named after one of Honolulu's mayors? Mm-hmm. HPR's Noe Tanigawa joins us this morning as we check on the progress of a much-needed makeover.
Right. It's funny when you think of how old, really, the Neil Blaisdell Center is. But you know what tipped me off into this story was seeing that fantastic Kamehameha III statue coming up in Thomas Square. I mean, this guy is pointing to the future here as he, of course, gestures to the righteousness of the way we conduct ourselves. But across the street, what's going to happen at NBC? Look at this. Been 3 years of planning and study here, Catherine, and they finally come up with a master plan. If you stand at the corner of Ward and King Street, look Diamond Head now, and imagine that the whole campus of the Neil Blaisdell Center goes up 18 feet. That's how it's going to be, by terracing and landscaping. All of the venues are going to connect on the second floor level. They're going to have the ground level all for the services, logistics, and whatnot down there. It's going to be kind of fascinating what they do here on this 22 acres. The concert hall, they said, has good bones, good acoustics. So you know those two wings that are on either side of the outside lanais? They're going to close those in up to the second level. So suddenly there's going to be a two-story lobby as you enter, and then on the sides, it'll be expanded up to the second level where they will now put in elevators, bathrooms, and reception areas. So you can have like a green room atmosphere on the second level of the concert hall. Go out the doors and you'll be on the same level to walk across from the back of the concert hall all the way to the arena on that second level. The parking lot is still going to be on the Diamond Head side, but it's expanding by a lot.
I should hope so.
Right. And you're not going to have to drive to all the way to the end of one side in order to get out on the other side either. They're chopping it in the middle. It's going to go up six stories.
Because we know how that is such a bottleneck when there's a popular show at the exhibit hall or whatever on the weekend. Oh, my goodness.
I know. People have noticed that it gets to be a problem. And talk about a big, big show there. Made in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. Okay. They had to break that up between the exhibition hall and the arena. No more in the future. The exhibition hall is going to be expanded by a third, so it'd be 95,000 square feet under that roof, and they're going to get rid of some of those posts that are every 10 feet right now down there. So it's going to be the concert hall raised up, kind of ceiling higher, the exhibition hall expanded, and there are going to be two new venues. The arena used to be used for sporting events a lot more. They're finding out they're not using it as much and that sporting events are not drawing as many people. So they're thinking about a small sports pavilion, about 1,200 seats, for games, volleyball, whatever.
Interesting.
Also, a smaller performance venue so that people who want to perform don't have to rent the entire concert hall. They can also get a smaller, maybe 1,200 approximately square foot venue there as well.
More intimate space.
Exactly, yeah. That you can fill, mm-hmm. you know, and you can do more experimental things in a smaller venue that way. And the city offices will be there. There will also be offices for some of the major arts partners, like perhaps the opera, maybe the symphony, maybe a halau. And they're also planning a hula venue there as well. But the huge changes, gosh, Catherine, they're going to come in the arena. Believe it or not, they're going to keep the original look of the arena, those scallop, the circle, all of that, but they're going to totally gut the inside.
Well, that's long overdue.
Don't you think?
Yes.
I mean, you know, Guy Ka'ulu Kukui, director of Honolulu's Department of Enterprise Services, he's spearheading this Blaisdell redevelopment. Super excited about what's happening there in the arena because it's going to change what we are able to do in that arena. Technologically, of course, people are doing a lot more than they did in 1964. We've got to get the technology up to the whole thing. But also, it has to do with the seating. Right now, the Blaisdell Arena seats about 8,000 people. But promoters need to adjust for the fact that it's a theater and around. When you put the stage on one side, you cannot sell maybe 2,000 of those tickets because they'll be behind the stage. Going forward, Guy says, the idea is to fix the stage on the Makai side, and then, you know, when you look up in the center of the arena, you see that there's, it actually goes up five stories. Mm-hmm. they're going to move the seats in, set them up amphitheater style, so that when they are done, the arena will still seat about 8,000 people, but you'll be able to sell every ticket. The last row will be a third closer to the stage than it currently is.
And better seats all around.
Yeah, that's exactly what Mr. Ka'ulu Kukui says.
We're trying to get into the market that includes these name acts in their prime. But there's a real simple math that promoters apply to a venue when they determine what kind of act they can book here. And they look at the seats, so they look at the quality of the seats and the quality of the sight lines. It's called scaling the house. Then they know what they can generate from ticket sales, which tells them the size of the act they can book. So our whole purpose of the reconfiguration is to push us into a whole different stratosphere of acts in Hawaii, because the reality is that many acts that choose not to come here don't come here because the promoter can't pay them enough to come here. And we're changing that math by changing the seating.
Pretty amazing, huh?
Yeah.
He's saying we can actually get a different level of talent in here. That would be pretty exciting. He's got the Seattle Center kind of in mind, you know,
right,
when he thinks about how this is going to work with the rest of the community. And he wants people to be walking and strolling around. They've got ideas for 5 bars and restaurants on that campus. They want people to walk around there. And Mr. Ka'ulu Kukui says he feels responsibility not just to the future, but to all the people who built the current incredible facility we've used for so long.
For folks who are old enough, of a particular vintage, you'll remember that what this replaced was the Civic Auditorium. And that served the community from about the 20s to the 30s. Civic was one facility that did everything. It had concerts, it had roller derby, it had wrestling, it had everything. It was our one venue. And the folks who delivered the Blaisdell for us, then the Honolulu International Center, with the grand name, the Honolulu International Center, right? And replaced it with a 22-acre, multiple facility campus that has served our community 54 years. So imagine, it served us well as our population almost tripled just on Oahu. That shows to me a lot of foresight, a lot of vision. They dreamed something that didn't exist anywhere in Hawaii before they built it here. That's what we're trying to do as we go forward. We're trying to deliver that same level of vision in this project.
Uh-huh. So the request for proposals is going out in November or December. This is going to be a public-private partnership. The private entity will help with the financing up front and also run the facilities after.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept. I know that money is always the big deal. I know there's been lots of politics back and forth on this. There was a lot of concern when initially they were going to have a developer come in and put up a high rise there. And it was interesting when I did go to the website this week, there were lots of Q&As that dispel a lot of, you know, myths, rumors, bad information that's out there.
ImagineBlaisdell.com, great place to go for more information on this. Of course, the effects on the opera theater, the Honolulu Symphony, the ballet, other, you know, organizations that use that venue, they're scrambling, wondering what to do next. We'll have a report on that. But they're hoping to begin breaking ground on the new Neil Blaisdell complex in 2020.
Okay, we'll see. Thanks, Noe. That was Noe Tanigawa talking about the NBC's overhaul. To find out more, visit hawaiipublicradio.org. Thanks, Bill Dorman, Derek Malama, and Dabney Goff at Pledge Central. This is The Conversation. And today on The Long View, our Neil Milner is back to do a deeper dive on the costs of college. We've been exploring this issue of education. Earlier, on an earlier show, we touched on the I Promise School started by athlete LeBron James.
Yes, and this is what LeBron James did with the I Promise thing. The promise is a kind of important code word now. Included in his educational thing included in that new school is a guarantee that under almost any circumstance, the student who finishes that school is guaranteed some money to go to college, a chunk of money to go to college at the University of Akron. And Promise scholarships have become a sort of a tempted trend to see if that increases the likelihood that low-income kids especially will go to college.
So that's the new buzzword, Promise.
So that's the new buzzword. And so I took a look at one of these that's been studied, and it's a program called the Degree Program. It's a Promise scholarship in the Milwaukee Public Schools. It started in 2011. They randomly selected 18 schools. They said, look, if you go to college, if you graduate on time, if you have a high attendance rate in high school, if you fill out a financial aid form, and if you keep a 2.5 average, we'll give you $12,000, which pretty much pays your way through a community college for 2 years and is a chunk of change if you want to go 4 years. So it's a classic kind of thing of, we'll promise you, if you do those things, that you'll get a chunk of money to go to college. So the result of it is kind of interesting and not very optimistic. It turns out that these students, compared to the control group, let's say, or that weren't selected, these students got more motivated in the sense that they talked about college more. Remember, you're talking about, say, students from 15 to 18. Talked about college more, applied maybe to more colleges, but they were no more likely to start college on time. Their performances weren't any better. And most important, their high school performances didn't really prove. I mean, part of this is the idea is that you're giving them an incentive to do better in high school. It turns out that the changes weren't negative, but they really weren't very much, if at all, in the direction of what you wanted. And the important thing about the study, which was done by the Brookings Association, is something that's very important, and it comes down to this. Money to students is not enough. And what you need to know is something about the school system. They said, look, you're talking about students. A lot of these students were marginal to come in. They're 15 years old. They hadn't done well in school. A lot of them didn't have good family support. And although they don't say it, the school system is pretty crummy, which it is. I know something about that school system. And they said what the school system lacked was all kinds of things that could reinforce what the money was doing. Bad communications about the project. More importantly, the lack of a kind of college culture, which us middle-class people take for granted, right? That there wasn't a lot of buzz about college and so on. So what essentially you were trying to do is to overcome all of those obstacles with a chunk of money. And that simply isn't enough.
That's not
enough. No, and one of the recommendations they make is, you know what? If you have a pot of money, you can't just give it for scholarships. You got to use that money to leverage in the schools things like more college counselors and all those other things. So that's an important lesson to learn, and it shouldn't surprise people about any kind of reform, that their education reform. It takes more than that. And I think LeBron James's approach is different in the sense that he's building a school he has along with it. And if you look at what that school is trying to do, whether it's implicit or explicit in regard to the study, they're building in the kind of stuff that would make these kinds of things more likely to be successful.
And then what about the snapshot here?
Well, the snapshot here is we have a limited program here. We call it the Hawaii Promise thing, and it applies to community colleges. And it essentially says if you're enrolled in community college, it doesn't have all these prior stuff, enroll in community college. Apply for any place that you can get money. What you don't get will pay for. That is that the state is trying to guarantee free community college education by doing it that way. So you get your loans from federal and all that other stuff will fill in. This is potentially quite important because people drop out of community colleges for money reasons. That's the primary reason. And then they never come back. So they don't get the benefits. This is an attempt to make it more secure so that at least the cost of community college itself isn't going to be the factor. I haven't seen any studies yet of whether that makes a difference, but the state is pretty excited about it. The University of Hawaii is pretty excited about it. And I think at one stage they've at least talked about expanding it to the four-year colleges.
I know in the community that I grew up, we had a system where the government would help you with some money for college and then say, but then you have to come back and you have to work for a couple of years, which is great because then you're guaranteed a job, you know, good experience, and you get that incentive.
Sure. There are all kinds of incentives like that, especially in professional programs where you get your education paid for part of medical school if you agree to practice in a community that really needs it. Or if you go to work for the public health service, there's those kinds of things. There's all kinds of financial incentives. You know, and those are nice ideas, but they're not taking on this earlier problem of getting people who haven't thought much about college at all and really have a lot of educational deficits in terms of how well they're doing in school. So I think the lesson is that incentives are really very useful, but they have to come with a lot of other things.
Right. The kids need the skills. We need to give them the support.
The kids need things that middle class, college educated parents take for granted. When my kids or my granddaughter, who's now six, she probably hears more things about college already than a lot of students who don't come from families that are that much oriented toward college education. And there's all kinds of social networks, you know, where do you go for a test? You got a college counselor. Which schools do this? Which schools do that? That's an important element, and by the way, a very important factor in increasing inequality between groups because of that.
And the price tag is just, oh my goodness. I mean,
well, yeah, but that's that other thing that I talk about. One of the issues on price tags is that people will say, you know, these private colleges where the prices says it costs you $70,000 to go. Think of it as a car. That's the sticker price. Everybody doesn't pay that, and in fact, most people don't pay it. So Wellesley College developed a website called myintuition.com that about now 40 private schools, including a lot of the elite schools, subscribe to. You can answer 6 easy questions about family income, about whether you own a house. It takes about 5 minutes. And you can click on a school there, and the school will tell you how much you're going to have to pay out of pocket. So it's kind of interesting. I mean, Yale, I did 2 schools. We'll talk about Yale for a second, since that's on everybody's mind right now because of the Kavanaugh hearings. Yale estimates the cost are $71,000 a year. We say, whoa, you know. If you have the median family income here, you got 2 kids and you're the only one in college, it turns out that Yale says you'll only have to pay about $5,000 out of your pocket. And the student will have to work about $3,000 worth of work study. So that makes it seem more eligible. The other school, it was more like $12,000. It makes it seem like it's
doable.
It's doable. And see, the attempt is to get people who don't think about private colleges. We're not talking about Punahou kids who get advice, you know, out their ears about what are the good private colleges and what they cost. Then you got people maybe who can afford a little more money. This is geared to people who maybe wouldn't think about those things. It's a important but small part of the difficulties of lower income students getting their expectations high enough, and in fact their, turns out, self-esteem high enough to apply to these schools and then to do well.
Okay, so if you've got folks out there who are listening, what's that website again?
Myintuition.org.
Okay.
It's fun to play with it, well, especially in my case, because I don't have kids that are college age anymore. So it's a fairyland. But it's an interesting, it's a really useful, easy tool to use.
Okay, all right. So hopefully people take advantage of that. Wasn't around when you and I were dealing with all this.
No, it was not.
All right, thanks so much.
Sure.
Neil Milner is a retired professor of political science and our contributing editor of our segment, The Long View. You can find out more on The Conversation's Facebook page. right. Thanks, Bill. You are back with the conversation. And now it's time for the reality check from our partners at Civil Beat. Today, we're featuring reporter Marcel Henry to get us up to date on the talk about rail, our very, very expensive train. Good morning.
Morning, Catherine. Good to be here.
Yeah, you've got a big meeting coming up on Thursday, huh?
Right. Tomorrow morning, there is yet another large consequential vote that could have serious ramifications for the rail project. It's the first action in a series of actions that need to take place over the next 60 days to meet some new demands that the FTA levied on the city and HART for the project. The vote tomorrow is a HART vote to see whether or not they will actually move forward with a partnership with the private sector to take some of the financial risk off the project. And the FTA is looking for them to have that decided in the next 30 days.
Right. Now, the FTA did want a little bit more from us, out of our pocketbook, right? Some reassurance that we will have the financial wherewithal to complete this system.
Right. So while HART has been putting together its financial recovery plan, which basically shows how it's going to deal with the lingering financial crisis, FTA has had its consultants doing their own assessment of the project. And they found that taking a conservative approach or saying, look, you guys probably need another $134 million just to be safe. And in the letter that the FTA sent the city and HART on Friday, they basically said, we want to see the recovery plan reflect that difference. In other words, you guys need to come up with that extra $134 million. It was interesting, at a press conference yesterday, Honolulu Mayor Kirk Caldwell addressed that, and he said, that's on HART. That is HART's kuleana. That is their responsibility since they got up to the legislature last year and said $8.16 billion, that's all we need. Well, turns out if we need a little more, HART, you guys need to come up with a solution.
Right, and I know that there was some concern by Honolulu's council chair, Ernie Martin, about how he was viewing this letter from the FTA, whether he thought it was a threat.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting that this letter came out, and it seems to be putting a lot of pressure on the city to act. And one of the side effects of that, I guess, is you're seeing these frictions between the mayor's office and the majority of the city council. They're starting to really resurface. So the mayor held this press conference. He very publicly signed a letter to Ernie Martin that urges him to take action and have the council take action. And basically he was saying that they've really put off a lot of what they need to do to resolve these issues. Later in the day, about an hour later, the chair addressed the mayor's press conference, and he kind of chided the mayor. He said, I think he forgot my number. I think he lost it. You know, I'm happy to go upstairs. It'll be easier for the mayor. So you're seeing kind of this ongoing dynamic that we've seen from these two rivals for the last several years. It's playing out all over again with the latest rail drama.
Right, and it's funny because I was looking at your comments following your article, and I know someone in the public said, well, gee, the phone, you know, works both ways. You could call, he could call. It's like, come on, guys.
Yeah, again, these guys, you know, they have some history. There's just, you can tell it's a very strained relationship between the two of them.
Yeah, okay. Well, I know you'll be on top of it, and so we'll look forward to your stories following that HART meeting tomorrow morning.
Thanks so much, Catherine.
All right. Thank you. That was Marcel Henry of Honolulu Civil Beat. To read his full story, visit civilbeat.org. The American Institute of Architects is marking its 60th anniversary, and more than a decade ago, the Honolulu chapter began inviting the public to vote for their favorite recently completed project. President Jeff Lewis joined us in the studio this week to talk about the competition among its members with some 37 newly completed projects. From single-family homes, condos, and businesses, the designs were not just here in the islands, but offshore, too.
It's always neat to see what the public chooses, you know, because as architects, you know, we sort of have our biases and stuff, but it's neat to see what the general public thinks is really exciting architecture and what they feel is appropriate for Honolulu.
So tell us about who judges this competition normally.
This year, the last 2 years, we've had out-of-state jury. 2 years ago was AIA Portland, and this year was AIA Seattle.
And how does that work? I mean, because communities are different. Do they bring to the table kind of different viewpoints?
Yeah, a little bit. You know, it's Seattle, for those who've been there, know it's a big metropolitan city, you know, and beautiful city and very leading edge, you know. And so, yeah, I think they bring a lot of lot of exciting experience that's applicable to Seattle. But, you know, and then they look at us here in Honolulu and think about maybe how it applies, you know, some of the things they're dealing with there and how it might apply here and judge our work accordingly.
So. Now, I know I've been asked to be a judge in, you know, small-time competitions, but I remember something recently I did up at the University of Hawaii, and we were kind of torn because there were two projects that were very fine, and we had to choose one. And so we ended up choosing one, but then the People's Choice ended up getting the other project. So it was really kind of nice to know that it kind of resonated with people.
And they're very personal, you know. I mean, there's, you know, through your own personal experience, you may see something in one project that resonates, where someone else may look at the other project and have an experience that makes them lean towards that or gravitate that way. So that's what's exciting about architecture. You know, it's exciting to look at it, to sort of absorb it and, you know, be influenced, you know, through your own experience in making decisions about maybe what's good or bad or better or worse. I don't know.
There is a lot of thought that goes into designing a project that a lot of people maybe don't realize all the work that's gone into when you do put pen to paper or get on the computer and you design something.
It's a all-encompassing process, you know, from doing research, programming with clients. I recently did a project up in Manoa, and it was a lot of history that I studied. And it was very exciting because they have a heiau on their property. And so really getting way back into the, you know, pre-contact time and understanding sort of what motivated the Hawaiian people at that time. So
and that project is the Manoa Heritage Center.
Yes, it is.
Tell us about that. I mean, how hard was it to then to do the deep dive on the history, but then come up with something that worked for the client?
Yeah. And it's kind of a twofold thing because the history really inspired me in a lot of ways when I looked at sort of the Hawaiian people and how the heiau is an agricultural heiau. And so it's really about studying the cosmos and the lunar calendar and what applied to their planting season. So that helped me understand how to orient the building and how to, and really sort of celebrate what the Hawaiian people did, because the heiau is really such an important artifact on that property. And then there's programming, and that's with the clients, you know, and then they have a program to run there, and so it's got a function for them. And it's sort of this marriage of form and function, and they sort of both have to be equal. You know, if a building is really exciting looking but doesn't function, then you've let down the client. And if it's functions really well but isn't so good looking, then you've let down the community. And so it really, they have to marry, I think, to be successful.
Well, I know in the driveway there, you've got the whole lunar calendar thing. Right, the star compass. And I know that the center was going to launch this summer, I think, a number of lunar programs. They had educators come in. So it was really, everything's just kind of woven in there.
Yeah, no, that was exciting because it kind of stemmed from needing a place for a bus to turn around. And I said, well, hey, you know, let's bring the star compass in. And you know, it's a great teaching opportunity for the children. You know, the third, fourth grade, almost all the kids from Honolulu go there for in the earlier years of their education. And so we're always looking for opportunities, teaching opportunities, you know, whether it's the rain garden, whether it's the star compass, the native Hawaiian garden, you know, it's all opportunities to share with kids and inspire them. As designers, you know, we can be pretty critical of things, but it's really neat to see how the general public reacts and responds to this work, because they, you know, they live with it every day, and for them, you know, it's less about the academics of it. It's more about just the experience of seeing a building and is it appropriate for Honolulu? Is it not appropriate? Does it function well? You know, and so it'll be really exciting to see how the public judges them. And it's always neat to see who the winner is because you never quite know with that. You know, as an architect, I could pick the ones I think are maybe more successful. But you never, when the People's Choice comes out, you're like, oh, yeah, that's cool. They picked that one. That's neat. I can see that. You know, it kind of makes sense when you see who wins usually.
And so you're going to announce that on the 15th. Is that right?
November 15th is the Design Awards. And that's both the AIA Honolulu Awards and then also the Pacific Region Awards as well. So it's going to be a combination this year, which we don't typically do. But it's our 60th anniversary. So it's a big event for us. You know, it's been the longest standing design awards in Honolulu, the AIA Awards. So it's a big thing, and it's important to us at AIA Honolulu, and we're excited to share it with the Pacific region.
So you've got also symposiums that are going to be tied to this event. Tell us about that.
We do. The design symposiums are a really exciting event coming up. It's November 13th through the 15th in conjunction with the the AIA CSI Expo. And then on that's Tuesday, and then Wednesday, that's on Wednesday, and we also have seminars on Wednesday, and on Thursday we have workshops that are open to the public. And it's really an exciting symposium. It's a four-part symposium. Last year UH did phase one. We're doing it in conjunction with University of Hawaii School of Architecture. So they did the first symposium, which was Building Voices. And we love the name because it's about bringing people together and finding solutions. And so this year it's Building Voices, Livable Communities, livable cities and communities. And then we have four tracks that we're going to be studying and really looking at: design in coastal extreme climate conditions, healthy citizens and communities, community mobility, and housing for all. So they're all issues that we're facing here in Honolulu, a lot of challenges. So the goal is really to bring people together, both locally and from the mainland, and some international people to just discuss with the city and the state and try to find solutions.
Right, because we're at a point now where rail is coming into the urban core, and there's a lot of focus on the plan and how it's all going to come together. And hopefully, as you build housing along the transit development areas, that you'll get people walking and riding bikes.
It's so exciting, rail, and I'm really glad it's being done. I really hope that it makes it all the way to Ala Moana, because, you know, Kakaako was designed as a walkable community, and it really needs that. I mean, they've eased up on parking. You know, they're doing all the right things to let rail be effective and serve its role. So we really hope it makes it there. And it's just neat, this new, you know, the Kakaako is so exciting. It's got these podiums where you have all the retail and stuff going on at the street, really vibrant, and then you have residences above that can really serve those, commercial spaces as well. The design is, you know, it's sort of the now of residential design, having these, you know, mixed-use buildings like that. It's been effective on the mainland in a lot of areas and seems to be pretty effective here in Kakaako as well. Yeah, I would encourage the public to come to the symposium because it's really, it's very inclusive with the community, and we would like to get community feedback. And why we call it Building Voices, again, is to bring people together and talk about solutions.
That was architect Jeff Lewis, current president of AIA Honolulu. And, you know, go online and vote for the People's Choice. You can find the links on our website. That wraps it out for us today. Now back over to Pledge Central.